Hey everyone, this is Brian from the Tennis IQ Podcast. Josh and I hope that you are enjoying the content and discussions that we put out week after week. If you'd like to support the podcast and help us to continue to produce quality episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/tennisiqpodcast/membership. Currently, we have three tiers of support: the fan level at $3 per month, the supporter level at $7 per month, and the champion level at $20 per month. Benefits of joining the Tennis IQ podcast community include episode transcripts, participation in book club discussions, and access to monthly masterclasses with me and Josh. For more on these benefits of support, head on over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/tennisiqpodcast/membership. Thank you so much. And now, on to the show. Welcome to the Tennis IQ Podcast. I'm Brian Lomax.
And I'm Josh Berger. And in today's episode, we are joined by Carrie Jackson. And this is an episode that I'm definitely, you know, very excited about. Carrie is someone that I've known for the past few years. I originally actually met her relatively early on after I had started my practice in early 2020. Certainly an interesting time for the world. But I was in a masterclass about early career and mid-career professionals within sports psychology. And it was certainly helpful. It was her and a woman named Sindra Kampoff. And the two of them led this masterclass on sports psychology in terms of, practitioners and really starting up their own practices and some best practices around that. And since then, she's actually been a mentor to me, and we've done some mentoring sessions in terms of both in terms of, you know, helping me really define what I do best, and also just, you know, being a sounding board at a lot of times. And I've been, you know, definitely have learned a lot from her. And she's been like you, Brian, has been another mentor that I've had. So it's been an episode that I've really been looking forward to for a long time. So a little bit about Carrie's background. Carrie Jackson is a performance and mental training expert, a certified mental performance consultant, and the author of On Top of Your Game: Mental Skills to Maximize Your Athletic Performance. Carrie's work and insights have been featured in multiple media outlets, including Runner's World, Outside Magazine, New York Times, Washington Post, U.S. News and World Report, and Huffington Post, to name a few. She is one of the world's foremost authorities on the mental and emotional challenges of recovering from injury. She co-authored the book Rebound: Train Your Mind to Bounce Back Stronger from Sports Injuries, and is the co-host of the widely regarded podcast, The Injured Athletes Club. As a coach and consultant, she has worked with thousands of athletes and coaches on mastering their mindsets so they can perform with less pressure, more consistency, and enjoy the process. Through her coaching programs and the Rebound membership, she brings mindset training tools to athletes that help them shift their focus from anxiety and self-doubt to resilience and confidence. Carrie's on a mission to help athletes challenge their limiting beliefs, regain confidence in their gifts, and fall in love with their sport again. We hope you enjoy this episode with Carrie Jackson. All right. We are very excited to welcome Carrie Jackson today. Thanks for joining us on the Tennis IQ podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So we'll start off the conversation in a way that we often will start these episodes. And it'd be great to learn a little bit more about your background and what led you to the field of sports psychology.
Yeah, you know, so my undergraduate degree was in psychology, and I'd known for a very long time I loved human behavior. I loved working with people and helping people and being of service. And so I knew I wanted to move into that area. But if you, like in high school, had told me I would be working with athletes as my career, I'd be like, that is hilarious. Like, where's the camera? Who's playing a prank on me? Like, I had no idea that this was the direction that I was going to go in. And what happened was, I didn't come into my sports until later in college, and my sports were primarily rock climbing and snowboarding, and then I also was race car driving for a little while. So it wasn't until later that I came into those. And as I was graduating, like literally walking across the stage, as I was walking across the stage, I realized, oh, I don't think I want to be a therapist. And at that time, you know, when I was graduating, that was before the whole positive psychology movement, like right before. And so it wasn't making sense to me the way that we were working with people. Like I really wanted to work on wellness instead of illness, and that just wasn't there yet. And so I realized, I don't think this is what I'm meant to do. And so, like any confused recent grad, I decided to move to Tahoe and snowboard for a while and figure stuff out and rock climb and have some fun. And so while I was there, you know, through some of my experiences, I started to reflect on the psychology of my own performance, and my friends as I was watching them, and it was really interesting thinking about that. Had no idea sports psychology even existed, but I knew I wanted to continue my education, and my mother knew that as well. And so she was actually at an open house because she was looking to get her master's in counseling. And while she was there, she saw a brochure for sports psychology, and she's like, "Oh, you know, I know you've been thinking about going to grad school. Like, I saw this and thought of you." And I was like, "What is this?" I had no clue. And went to the next open house and ended up signing up, and the rest is kind of history. So I had no idea this was the direction that I was headed. But once I saw like the research and the theory and sort of started to understand what sports psychology was and how you could use it, that was the closest thing that I was looking for at that point, where I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do.
I think what's cool about that story, Carrie, is that in some ways you were client zero,
Yeah.
right? And
Absolutely.
so I'm curious, you know, what were some of the revelations that you worked through as an athlete to, you know, bring the mental game and its importance, you know, higher priority in your mind? And it probably led to
Yes.
some other things that you were doing, but how did that transform you as an athlete when you started to explore that material?
Yeah, it was interesting. Some of it was reflecting back on. So once I sort of made those realizations, I had already been done racing, but I would reflect back and recognize like how I was so nervous on the start line, like not butterflies, like dragons in my stomach. Like I had a lot of physical activation in my body. That was how my anxiety manifested in my nerves. But as soon as I hit the gas, gone, like immediately gone, and super focused. And like, so I was like, oh, that is really interesting. Like, why it's just like, it was really like a flip of the switch for me. So I would reflect on that. And then with climbing, some of the things that really stood out to me that had my wheels turning was, so in rock climbing, you can, there's different ways to climb. So when you're on top rope, it means there's an anchor at the top of the rock, and it's very secure, and you're climbing up, and it's like, you know, really, if you know what you're doing, it's the safest thing you could do. Lead climbing is a little bit different. So when you're the lead climber, you're placing gear in the rock and then relying on that gear to hold if you fall. So there's a lot more commitment involved when you're lead climbing. So I would watch my friends. We'd, you know, top rope, and like they could do it with their eyes closed, just like they're, you know, running up the rock almost. And then they would lead climb the same climb and be paralyzed on the rock. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. Like they can do it. They 100% can do it, but everything shifted here in the mind, right? Everything shifted there. So that was another revelation I had, where I was like, oh, this is really interesting. How do you trust and have confidence that you're the same climber when there's a lot more at stake, and there's a lot more like nerves that are affecting you at that moment. So those were two of the big things that I noticed. And then of course, once I got into my studies, like noticed all kinds of other things. And really, that's where a lot of the work that I do now with my injured athletes came from, my own injury experience while I was in the middle of my graduate studies. And sort of, I was client zero again, but this time injured client zero, and learned a lot from that process too.
Could you tell us a little more about that, just in term, if you feel comfortable, just a
Yeah.
little more about that injury and what that recovery process looked like?
Yeah, absolutely. It was so I had an injury to my left knee a couple years before my graduate program, and I had a torn meniscus, had to get arthroscopic surgery, and I had a really hard time recovering from that injury. Like, I really struggled with pain management during rehab. I had a very hard time trusting my knee, was really nervous about injuring it again. I just had a very hard time with that recovery, and that was my first like major injury. And so then fast forward, I'm in the middle of my graduate studies. I was just coming towards where was I? I was just like, I was right in the middle of it. And it was the I think it was close to the end of the first year. And it was the last I was snowboarding, and it was the last run of the day, last run of the season, of course. And so, and it's sort of the classic, like, I was with my snowboarding partner at the time, and he's like, "Hey, do you want to go again?" And I was like, "Yeah, you know what? Let's do more, one more run." Like, oh my God, no, famous last words. So, and it was a total fluke accident that happened. And what was interesting about it was, well, there's two funny things. One was, they're putting me in this, it was very apparent I was injured, and it was the same knee, but different injury. This time I tore my MCL, and they put me in the sled. And when I was working at, I used to work at a ski resort when I lived in Tahoe. And I had always wanted to volunteer to be one of the people they take in the sled so they can practice taking people down the mountain. And it never worked out with my schedule. And so then I was laying in the sled going, well, be careful what you wish for. You finally, hey, yay, now I get
It
to see
worked
what
out
this is
now.
like. And I was like genuinely excited to see what it felt like as I'm injured. But the other thing, like as soon as we started down that mountain, I thought to myself, like, okay, your recovery is now your sport, and everything you were putting into snowboarding now is going to go into your recovery, and you're going to take everything you're learning in your program about optimal performance on the field and on the court and apply it to coming back from this injury. And that is exactly what I did. And the difference was huge, like so profoundly different from that first injury to the second. It was incredible. And I came back to have my best season ever, both physically and mentally, because of the work I did during that time. Like, it really was an incredible experience. And that's when I went like, oh my gosh, everybody needs to have this information to come back from this. And it wasn't until later that it really hit home that, oh my gosh, these athletes, when they're injured, during a time when they need the most support, they're getting the least. Like, they're getting support for the physical side, but not the mental recovery. So it's something it's a part of the work that I do that I really, really love.
Now, recovery is now your sport is one of the
Yes.
chapter titles in your book
Yes.
Rebound. Part of it is also to address sort of the potential loss of athlete identity. Can you go into that a little bit more about how you've applied that, whether we call it a mantra or sort of a trigger phrase or whatever we want to call it,
Yeah.
how that has changed the perspective of some of the athletes that you've worked with?
Yeah, I think one of the things, that phrase is really sticky, and my athletes really like that, my injured athletes. And I think part of the reason they do is because one of the things that help it's like applying the athlete mindset to the recovery process. So, and it helps them stay connected to their athletic identity, because just like you said, when you're injured, one of the things that athletes struggle with is, well, who am I if I'm not carry the snowboard or the rock climber, if I'm not, able to play tennis anymore? Like, who am I if I don't have that in my life? Like, I don't know how to exist without that being a part of my life, when it's such a big part of not only what you do, but who you are. And so that's a big loss during that time. So one of the things I'm wanting to help the athletes do is recognize you are still an athlete, but now your recovery is your sport. Right? Like, this just happens to be where you are on your athletic journey. And just because you can't do the thing doesn't mean you cease to be a tennis player, you cease to be an athlete. Like, you are still an athlete. And so that mantra, that recovery is now your sport, helps them stay connected to their athletic identity, and also helps them start to come to a place of acceptance and look at what is still within my control that I can do. Because it's really easy when you're injured to just think about all the things you can't do versus the things that you can. So that also helps with that sort of perception of control piece as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I find, sometimes in my work with when I work with athletes that, are coming back from an injury, there's a lot of comparison that takes place. Comparison to maybe some of the other people around them, comparison to where they were prior to the injury, and that can certainly lead to a lot of frustration and I think, slow down that recovery process. What is, the approach that you take after somebody's injured, once they're, coming back to the court or back to the field or whatever it may be? What does that approach look like that you utilize?
Yeah, so that's one of the places we'll see sometimes a spike in emotions. Like, so there's different times in the injury recovery process where we'll see like some of the bigger sort of challenging emotions come up. I don't like to call them negative emotions because we're supposed to feel all of the feelings, like, and I'm big on that with my injured athletes. But in the beginning, like the onset of injury, dealing with setbacks and then return to like higher intensity training and competition are the times we see those spikes. So with that, like as you're moving back into higher intensity training and competition, one of the things that comes up a lot is fear of re-injury. And so that often is one of the things that we're addressing because sometimes that might be the point at which athletes are getting maybe closer to the circumstances within which they were injured, depending on the injury. So it's very natural for the brain to go into protective mode. So that a lot of the work around that time is there's a couple different things that happen. One is sometimes is dealing with that fear of re-injury and what are the thoughts that are there and making sure that they have tools to both relax the body and relax the mind so that we're not creating tension in a way that could potentially contribute to re-injury. So the other thing that's happening during that re-entry period too is that's really challenging for athletes is sometimes holding, it's not pushing through, it's holding back. So you get really excited when you see the light at the end of the tunnel and you're starting to feel good and you're starting to feel strong again. And you might, and in those moments have a tendency to push a little too hard too soon. And so being very thoughtful about the re-entry and helping athletes recognize that a sign of your mental toughness isn't whether or not you can push through, it's whether or not you can hold back. We know you can push through. You're an athlete. Like that's, you're used to that. You're used to rising to the occasion and being able to perform and pushing through the pain of the effort that's there. But that template that we use to be successful in performance does not always apply during injury and how to be successful during injury. So we have to flip the script on sort of mental toughness and what it means to be mentally tough when you're in that phase of your recovery. And like, how can you hold back when you really want to move forward?
Yeah, and I feel like tennis players that I've worked with are definitely the push through type, and they want to rush it. And then some of them have re-injured, the same thing has come back. And what's been interesting, Carrie, is that the second time around, there was more of a, shall we say, a discipline process with the end of that road, and how to take it slow and how to come back the right way. And they definitely bought into it more because of what had happened the first time. But maybe I think with the first time, the disciplined process wasn't necessarily as clearly spoken or worked on with the therapy team and the coaching team, et cetera. But because the re-injury happened, that became a part of it. And I'm curious, what's your experience in seeing those kinds of things, even with re-injury, with the athletes you've worked with?
With some of my individual athletes that have been had multiple injuries, it's sometimes they come to me because they're starting to recognize I have to do something different. Like I keep, this isn't working. And with some people, when they go through that process, they hit the second injury and they're like, okay, I'm listening now. Like but sometimes there are some athletes that they are only going to learn the hard way. And it's not until they get to that point of like, okay, I can't, I don't want to go through this again. I need to do something different and what I'm doing isn't working and I need help. That then it's like really trusting that process. It's still hard. So my work with them, there's a couple I'm thinking of in particular that really just struggle with that flipping the script on what it means to be successful and really being very intentional with actually recognizing and celebrating the times that they do something for their recovery. That understanding that that is an equally important part of your training, and that And recognizing that as a win instead of seeing it as like, oh my God, I'm wasting my time. Like everybody else is gaining fitness while I'm losing it, which is a big concern with my injured athletes. And so it's hard to, you know, kind of like have the tools to be able to manage that anxiety in particular as well and trust the process and know. One of the other things I tell my injured athletes often is it's never going to go as fast as you want it to because you don't want to be injured in the first place. So you got to be patient with the process. So it's, yeah, timelines really mess with athletes too, man. If they have an original timeline in their mind of how quickly they're going to come back from something and then their body is in a different place and it they get to that point and like their body's not ready, but they held that timeline in their mind, it feels like a failure instead of like an adjustment that needs to be made. It's, I feel like I've been thinking about this a lot lately where I was like, man, I wonder what it would be like if we didn't give timelines. And we need to, because we need to have, you know, like it's an important part of the recovery process to, you know, to kind of have that. But I swear with most of my athletes, it feels more like when you are getting your kitchen remodeled or something and they tell you it's going to be 2 months, but really it's going to be 6. So you just, if you're injured, just add on a little bit of time or just know that really timelines can really mess with your psyche and your mindset. And so being, you know, if you come up against a timeline and recognize that to know that that's what's happening. Like, it's not that you failed. It's not that you're not going to heal, right? Because a lot of the what ifs come up at that time too. So that's another place where emotions can spike. So it's a lot of the what ifs is like, oh my God, what if I never get better? What if I'm never going to be able to come back? Like, which is very natural too for that to come up at that point. But just to know, like, it just means your body's not ready yet.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And I think being patient about that process and about that timeline, you know, especially if there are certain milestones on that timeline that someone's trying to come back in time for, whether it's
yes.
high school or college season or a particular tournament in tennis, for instance, or, you know, maybe that's coming up and they feel like they might be ready, but they want to have some lead up time, you know, leading into it. But you brought up something interesting before when you were talking about your own injury with your knee and trusting your knee and trusting your body, you know, after that injury, do you find that is often one of the bigger challenges that, you know, maybe an athlete is physically back to where they were, or at least close to where they were, but that trust piece can take a little bit longer to break through? I know I've seen that with a cross country athlete that I've worked with where physically he's fine now, but
yep.
You know, he still finds himself thinking back to it repeatedly. So
yeah.
I'm curious if you have found that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Like often for some athletes, they're physically cleared before they're mentally ready, right? Like so their confidence hasn't, and especially if you aren't working deliberately on this mental piece, like your confidence hasn't had a chance to catch up with the physical recovery. And so with that in particular too, I mean, anytime you're injured, any sensation you have there almost becomes like a trigger. And the body's natural tendency with pain or with sensation that you're afraid might mean something in that part of your body, we brace against it. It's sort of an immediate reaction. And so part of the work is, you know, it's like, you don't think about your elbow. Like, when's the last time you thought about your elbow or your earlobe, unless you've injured your elbow or your earlobe, right? So, but, you know, if I feel anything in my shoulder or my knee, I'm like, oh, what's that? What's happening? And depending on where you're at in your recovery, it's, that can be scary because it makes you think like, oh my God, is something wrong? Did I push too hard? Am I re-injured? Is it not healed? And can I trust it? And also a big challenge with athletes is like understanding what pain is pain I can push through and is okay to push through, and what pain is a signal that I need to stop, and not quite knowing what that is. Pain is so very complex. So the trusting that part of your body is something that comes up with a lot of athletes. And so one of the ways I like to talk about it too is changing the language that we use to describe that part of our body. Because how many times have you heard people like, oh, that's my bad knee, or that's my bad shoulder, and that's my good shoulder. Is that your good shoulder or your bad shoulder? Like, we always use those terms of good and bad to think about that part of our body. And so one of the things I have my athletes do is we work on personifying that, the injured body part. So this is Peggy Sue. I'm pointing to my left shoulder. And so when I talk to Peggy Sue, my experience of the pain is very different than when I'm feeling the pain and I'm thinking about my bad shoulder, and it's a very sort of internalized process. So what that does when you personify it, you give it a name, and there's like different things we'll do with that. It creates psychological distance, which means it helps you to change your perspective on how you're dealing with that situation, because you're looking at it from a different vantage point. It gives you some space from it. So when I'm talking to Peggy, you know, when I feel pain in my shoulder and I'm talking to Peggy Sue, I'm like, oh, hey, why are you talking to me? What's going on? Do I need to do something for you today? Instead of like, oh my God, what's happening? I'm so frustrated. This has been 2 years. I'm going to lose my mind. Like, it's a totally different internal dialogue and totally different emotional experience. So that's one of the things that I work on with, like, is really paying attention to those, just normalizing, like, it's totally normal for your brain to go, you know, be in protective mode and be very hyper aware of any sensation you have. And then how can we shift the language so that we shift the experience around it, so we don't intensify the pain that we feel? Because when you trigger your stress response and you do that bracing, it intensifies the pain that you're experiencing.
I love that that perspective of, you know, creating some psychological distance. I know you wrote your book probably before this one came out, but you have Chatter in the background, and Ethan Cross talks about the exact same thing, right? With almost developing like your coach's voice, using your name and speaking to yourself in the second person, right? So I think that's wonderful. I wanted to go back to something you alluded to earlier, Carrie, because I think this is relevant to tennis players, is that when you are injured, you can become isolated. And an individual sport like tennis, that's certainly something that can happen. Even when you're on a tennis team, any team sport, that can happen, right? But tennis players in particular can become isolated. And I know a lot of the athletes I've had to work with, we've worked on how one, you know, can create more social support and continue to feel connected and all that other stuff. But would love to hear you give your thoughts on how you work with that aspect of things, especially for the individual athletes like tennis players.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it is something that that happens with a lot of athletes, and especially with my athletes in individual sports. It does take on a different, there's unique challenges for both, unique challenges for athletes that are in an individual sport, and then unique challenges for athletes in a team sport. And one of the things that we know about injury recovery is one of the biggest factors that impact successful outcomes is having strong social support. So it's a really important part of the process. And one of the things that happens is sometimes we feel, you know, as an injured athlete, you feel isolated, and sometimes you isolate yourself, right? So both of those things are happening. So you kind of have to look at both of those factors. Like, am I holding back? Am I isolating myself because it's too painful, psychologically painful, to talk to the people that are doing the thing that I so desperately want to do? Or it's hard for me to watch my teammates out there playing when I can't play. And then I feel guilty because I'm not excited for them, and I'm just thinking about myself. Like, all kinds of emotions come up around this. So it is really, so I talk about that a lot. I talk about support and different types of support that we need, and how to ask for the support that we need. Cause there's sort of a big myth around support that, like, well, if you really cared about me, you would know the exact support I need and be able to give it to me in the exact moment that I need it. And if only, says every, you know, person in a relationship across the world. So, like, it just doesn't work that way. Like, if only my, you know, and we just have that expectation. And, but really, when we're talking about providing support, everybody has a different skill set with that. And so sometimes you have to ask for the support that you need, and you have to, and what's interesting is when I work on this with my athletes is sometimes it doesn't even dawn, especially, and this is where this is a unique thing with my individual athletes. Well, I'll say my individual athletes that are on also on a team sport, right? So their performance is individual, but they have a team. It doesn't even dawn on them. So like tennis, like it might not even dawn on you to spend time with some of your teammates outside of tennis. Like, and it just is like, but this, you know, this is where we connect, and this is where our time is, and this is where we see each other, that it just doesn't even, like, oh, I guess I could, see if they could, come over and hang out, or like we could go meet for coffee or whatever it is. So being, being proactive about building your support team so that you aren't isolated is a really important part of the recovery process also.
Yeah, no, I think you're bringing up a really good point. You know, tennis being an individual sport, but a sport, whether it's high school, college, adult leagues, where people take, play on a team. I find, and I know Brian, we've discussed this in the past, that a lot of tennis players grow up playing for themselves. They play in tournaments. Maybe they're with a parent or their parents, and they're really playing for themselves. And then all of a sudden, they're in this team environment. And I think, when an athlete is injured, there is that tendency to either feel isolated or isolate themselves. And I think, in a certain way, it can be that reminder. It's that reminder of, okay, this is what I'm missing out on right now. This is what I'm not able to participate. And then, it's some of those difficult questions. Will I be able to play again? Will I be as good as I was in the past? Will I be able to participate in these upcoming things? Whatever it is. So no, I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of, how athletes do isolate themselves or, become isolated during that time. So are there some, when we think about, certain tools that people can use, whether it's in this situation with isolation or other things related to the injury process. And I know we want to talk about some things outside of injury as well, but what are some specific tools that you will work on with athletes or that you'll suggest to people that they can start to implement in overcoming some of these challenges?
Yeah, one of my favorites actually is an acronym I came up with which is like, if you want to go far in your recovery, you have to feel, accept, recover. So FAR is an acronym for feel is the first piece. Like, you have to feel your feelings in order to get to a place where you can accept where things are and then go, okay, now what? What do I want to do? And that process of feeling your feelings, I'll have like in the book, I call it the emotion decoder, which it's just a list of different emotions. And you can kind of go down the list. And we, it's called, it's affect labeling basically. And so when you're able to actually accurately label the emotion that you're feeling in that moment, it has this beautiful way of helping to sort of dissipate and move through the emotion, right? So you're like, oh, that's what we're dealing with. It's like if something's buried under the sand and you're like, I know something's there, but I don't know what it is. And you dig it out and then you go, oh, that's what it is. Like, that's exactly this process of like, once you look on that list and go and see the emotion and you're like, oh my gosh, that's what I've been feeling. So it's the ability to really like label those feelings and allow yourself to feel them. Because what's amazing about emotions, when you really allow yourself to feel the emotion, our emotions actually have a shelf life. I need to look this up again. I want to say that the research shows it's like about 90 seconds. So you'll see this in toddlers all the time, like a toddler that'll lose their ever loving mind about something. And then they're like, what's for lunch? So because they really feel their feelings. They don't fight against the feeling. They don't add different narrative to it to fuel the fire in a different way. Like, they just like experience the feeling and move on. So if we allow ourselves to, and I think we don't allow ourselves to do that, to really feel the feelings, because we're, I think sometimes this is, there might be cultural norms around like not sharing feelings that are make anybody uncomfortable, right? And so our tendency is to move away from uncomfortable feelings instead of moving into them and through them. So we think like, I don't like how that feels. I'm going to go this other direction instead of like, how do I move into this feeling instead so that I move through it to a place of acceptance and then recovery. So the language I like to use with that acceptance piece is the word prefer. Like, I would prefer for this to be different. I would prefer to not be injured right now. I'd prefer to have met this timeline, to not be dealing with this setback, but here I am, but this is where I am, right? So it helps with that like acceptance. That's such a big part, because it's not until you really accept where you are that you can really focus on your recovery and like, okay, now what do I want to do? So that's a big, I love that tool. That's like my, like, sort of holds the space for all of it. And then we'll dive into other specific tools as well.
Well, what I like about that, Carrie, is you're really teaching them more vocabulary around like emotional granularity instead of just like good, bad, like you were talking about earlier.
Yes.
We're going, you know, we're being much more specific about what it is that we feel. Because you can say, I just feel bad.
Yeah,
Okay.
exactly.
Right.
Yeah,
What
yeah. And our brain
exactly?
likes to do that because our brain is like our brain is wired for speed over accuracy. So it likes to clump things into categories. And so that's where we're like, this is bad. This feels bad. Everything's bad. Like instead of, well, let's dissect that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. And then we're teaching them a better vocabulary about how to express themselves. And that can
Yes.
obviously be expanded into other areas of
Yes.
mental and emotional performance as well. So I think that that's a really cool part of your strategy with athletes. So I really like that. One of the models that I like to use is from Santi and Pietrantoni. I don't know if that one is in your book, but they have the affective model of injury recovery, basically three stages of denial, distress, and determined coping, kind of reducing
Yes.
it into those three things. And then the understanding that within the space of 10 minutes, you could go all through all three of those, right?
Yep.
It's not a graduation process, right? And I'm sure you see that with your athletes. How do you prepare them for the fact that you're not going to move from one phase to the next, but you could experience all of these different stages
Yeah.
all along the way?
Yeah, I talk a lot about the emotional roller coaster. And you're exactly right. Like not only are you going to go through all kinds of different emotions from the onset of your injury to you're back in action. But within a day, you can go through a whole roller coaster of emotions. And that's a nice model. I like that model. And then also I use a lot the stages of grief model for athletes and to help, and when you introduce those different models, you can see the athlete recognizing like, oh, that's where I am. And it just sort of normalizes what you're going through. Like, this is a stressful thing that you're going through. This is a stressor. And whether or not it's stressful has to do with whether you feel like you have the ability to handle the situation in front of you. And it's a challenge. It's a big challenge going through that recovery process. So absolutely you can go through, and sometimes with that feeling of denial, people will, I think sometimes make the assumption that that's something that's bad or wrong when really it serves an important part of the process. Like it's there for a reason. We have denial, that ability of denial for a reason. It's when it's prolonged that we then need to look at, is this now getting in my way? But like that ability to like I can't look at this right now is a way that we manage very big feelings of anxiety that we're not ready to look at just yet. So it's okay. Like if you're, it's okay if you're feeling denial, or if it's okay if you're avoiding is another sort of coping skill that I think we think is not effective or not good. It's actually very effective when it comes to managing anxiety. So those things have their time and place. It's if you're stuck there, then we look at like, okay, now we need to explore what that is. But you absolutely, I think the other thing with that model of like, is to know you will come back around. Like you will get back to determined coping. Like it is a cycle. It's not linear. It's not, and you might go through that a lot during your injury recovery process.
Yeah, because that's definitely like something I like to check in with every session that I have with somebody. Hey, how's it going with where we are? How are you doing getting back to that determined coping piece?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Carrie, you brought up the point of denial and how, and I think this can be very common with athletes where they have a certain uncomfortable thought or feeling, and rather than being able to look at it, accept it, really note actually notice how long it lasts for, and you brought up somewhere around 90 seconds, they'll deny it or ignore that it's there, try to push it away rather
Yep.
than accepting it, rather than acknowledging it, and then trying to process it and move forward from there. And I feel like the skill of mindfulness and meditation can is definitely a tool that can be helpful with for athletes with that process of starting that to really notice and recognize, and just be aware of different thoughts and sensations that come up. And as you said, generally they don't stick around for that long, right? If the somebody that I listen to a lot, Sam Harris, he talks about in his app Waking Up, how if you Really try to notice the thought, right? We're meditating, maybe we get distracted by a certain thought. Really try to look at it. Really try to, notice the thought itself and notice what happens to it, that it does start to go away, right? It is like that toddler that you're describing. So I think that that's definitely a skill that can be helpful. And it's, oftentimes it's not the emotion itself, it's what happens next. It's the fact that it's pushed away. It's the fact that it's never actually addressed. It's, it is avoided, and then it builds on that. So I think, that's a really important skill to be able to help athletes get to that point of acceptance and awareness of the thought, the difficult thought or emotion itself that can be, that can definitely take place during this challenging time of an injury, and then be able to process it and start to move on. I know we also wanted to talk about some other things outside of, outside of injury as well. And I know that, you released your first book in 2013, On Top of Your Game, which I know talked about the field of sports psychology a little bit more broadly. And you would love to hear about, the journey and what led you to writing that. And if you could tell us a little bit about what that included.
Yeah, that book was born from, I had had a string of clients that were experiencing such intense pre-performance anxiety and anxiety about performance that they were starting to question whether or not they wanted to continue in their sport. And then for all different reasons, some were injury related, some were not at all. And just putting pressure on themselves to perform. And I, worked with these athletes, and some of them came back to have their best season ever after they were at a point of wanting to leave and wanting to quit. And not because they didn't love their sport. These people loved their sport. They just had so much anxiety that it was starting to become, they couldn't handle it. And it was starting We're starting to question whether or not it was worth it to continue because of that. And they just needed the tools to know how to be able to take the pressure off when the pressure's on. So after doing that work and having them, come back and have this, I was like, oh my God, it like broke my heart to think about athletes that were out there that were getting ready to quit because they just didn't have the tools to manage their performance anxiety. And I was like, okay, I gotta not, I need to put this book out and kind of share this with everybody. So that was how that book sort of came to be. And I always knew it was a professional and a personal goal. And I knew that there was a book in me that wanted to come out. And so, so that was why, and I love to write, like it's something I've always loved. So, so that book was born, and I knew I wanted it to be something very, very hands-on and very, like, here's what you do. Not just like, here's some great ideas and here, but like, here's how you actually do it. So there's tools in there, and similar to Rebound, like there's actual tools in there to be able to cultivate the skills that we're talking about. Cause we don't often think about, right, like confidence as a skill, but like it is a skill, and here's what you do to work on that.
We had an eminent coach in the tennis world on our podcast a few months ago, Nick Saviano, and one of his core tenets of being a successful elite athlete is that enjoyment must be one of the leading ingredients for success. And I, in reading a little bit about your book, you may not have used exactly that word, but I think you try to help athletes really reconnect with their passion for sport and competition, which I think is, there's a bit of enjoyment in there as well, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you talk about that as a theme of performance in your work?
Yeah. It's a big part of sort of the my philosophy and the work that I do with my athletes, because your sport is really meant to add joy to your life. It's, and so if it's become a stressor and it's become something that produces anxiety, we need to look at that. Like, how do we rekindle that passion? How do you get back to that love for it? And does that mean, are you at a place in your life where you need to redefine your relationship with your sport? So sometimes that's confusing for athletes when they're like, why don't, it doesn't mean the same thing to me now as it did when I first started. So sometimes you can come back and think about like those first moments where you started to fall in love with your sport, and like, how do you get some of that back? And it's just this, over time, athletes have a tendency to then put pressure on themselves to perform to a certain expectation. And then that starts to remove some of the joy from it. And so getting back to that place of play. And you know, you as an athlete, you're spending a tremendous amount of time on tennis. Like you're spending, a lot of resources and time and money and effort. And like, so when you get there, you deserve to enjoy it. So how do we kind of flip the script on like, the performance is actually the celebration. The performance is the party. Like the training is what gets you there. And now it's time to play. Now it's time to like enjoy this time with your sport that you are so blessed to have. So that's a like helping athletes find their joy again is a big part of what I love about my job.
I think that's awesome. And I think that's something that it's very common for athletes. You know, they start playing their sport for a certain reason. They enjoy it. They like being around their teammates. And at a certain point, as they start playing more competitively, maybe, you know, start taking more seriously, their goals can really shift, and they can, you know, it can be very easy to lose sight of, of those goals of, you know, or of those original reasons why they started playing, right? What, yeah. You know, that enjoyment, that play piece, you know, it becomes all about performing and winning at times. And it can be very easy to lose sight of that. So what is, you know, can you tell us just a little bit about sort of, you know, your process of maybe helping somebody come back to that? You know, I know you talked about thinking back to maybe some of those original experiences with the sport, but, you know, maybe also, you know, helping an athlete figure out, you know, why do I play? Why do I do what I do? And, you know, drill in a little bit more into that maybe motivation piece and enjoyment piece.
Yeah. So that is part of it is like, kind of, we have a conversation about like, tell me a little bit about your history and your sport and like when you first got into it and what are some of the things that you love about training and competition and playing in your sport. And so that's part of it is just like reigniting that flame a little bit, because oftentimes they haven't even thought about it or talked about it, that their love of it for a while. And so getting it, so kind of, it's like relighting the pilot light sort of like, oh, that's right. That I forgot this was here. And now it's starting to feel warm again. Like, and to just be able to have those conversations. And then sometimes it's also making sure like that they have clearly defined goals, because when you have something that you're working towards, that helps with motivation and making sure that the goals are something that they are feeling connected to versus goals that they think they should do, or someone else tells them they should do, like goals that are meaningful to them. So that can be a part of that process as well. And then also sometimes it's, if they're at a place where, what's interesting is sometimes athletes come to this place of transition that can create some cognitive dissonance, which means like my sport used to mean this to me and I feel like I should go back to that, but it doesn't mean that to me anymore. And it's confusing. Like it used to be my everything. And now there's other things I also enjoy, or maybe you've been injured and you're not playing to the same capacity that you were before yet. And like, so how do I shift my definition of success and what it means to be now and have my athlete ego be okay with that? So that can be a huge transition. So if they're in that phase, then it's like, there's other conversations we're having to like, see what does that sport really mean to you? And do you want to still be connected to it regardless of the outcome? Like, is it just something that you want to have part of your life? That was a really interesting thing. I'm sure you guys saw this during COVID that a lot of athletes were facing when there was no competition, was like, well, what does it mean to me now? Like, where's my motivation for my sport now that competing is off the table? And that was a really interesting period where athletes really had to look at that and kind of figure that out for themselves.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting period, depending where you live too, where could you even train? You know,
right.
I live in the Northeast. And all indoor tennis clubs were shut down. All public park tennis courts were locked up. Couldn't do anything. And, it's a very difficult time for, you know, athletes, regardless of sport, but certainly for tennis players. I'm curious, Carrie, in your work with tennis players, you know, Josh and I probably have some biases on how mentally challenging we think the sport is. But, you know, in your work, what are some perhaps common, unique, maybe not unique, but maybe some common challenges that you've noticed that are perhaps unique to tennis?
Yes.
For athletes that maybe are not as big of a deal in some other sports.
Yeah. I think with tennis, with my tennis players, like a couple things that come to mind that come up with many of them. And one is like, has to do with momentum and how quickly they feel like that can shift, and understanding the ways in which they can influence that, I think, is something that comes up a lot. I mean, and another is, it's like some of my tennis players, they come to, one of the things they love about the sport is like, it's all up to me, which other athletes would be like, oh my God, I would never want to play tennis because it's all up to me. Right. Like they, but the ones, you know, that some of them they're, so what's interesting is that sometimes your greatest strength is also your greatest challenge. And so that's something that comes up with my tennis players a lot, which is like this intense sort of drive and sometimes perfectionism, and the ways that that can serve them, and then the ways that it does not serve them, and sort of exploring that. So that's something that comes up with my tennis players a lot too. And then just that, like, man, emotional regulation, like how do I really have the tools to be able to let go of the last shot, because that last shot doesn't matter, it's out of my control. Like, how am I able to so the speed at which you have to have the ability to do that is something that's unique in tennis versus like even other individual sports that I work with. For them, it's like there's so much time, like golf or triathlon, or, you know, there's so much time to marinate over like something that happened that you wish had gone differently. But it's like you have to have the tools to regroup immediately. So how do you do that? So that's another one that's sort of uniquely challenging for my tennis players.
Absolutely, and I think you're bringing up a lot of points that we've mentioned in past episodes about how do we move on after that last point. You know, the challenges of it just being you out there. Maybe, you know, there's certain contexts where you have a coach, and certainly in doubles you have another person that you're playing with. Mm-hmm. But in general, it's you out there against an opponent, you know, often for a long period of time, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours plus, you know, can certainly be more, and being able to handle that and having the resilience to handle those ups and downs that come up. I think if we go back a little bit to the injury piece, I think, and I know we were talking about this beforehand a little bit, that the types of injuries in tennis can also be different than other sports, where it might be, you know, something overuse, like a tennis elbow or something related to someone's shoulder from serving, mm-hmm. or it could be a nagging injury. Mm-hmm. In your experience, have you seen, you know, how do those types of injuries, where maybe it's something that has stayed with an athlete for years, and maybe it flares up at times and gets worse at times, or, you know, it calms down a little bit. What is your approach for working with an athlete like that and helping them, you know, overcome some of those challenges?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of that with the sort of intermittent injury or the flare-ups or the chronic injuries, that sort of thing, sometimes it's really looking at, like, can we figure out what are the things at play when it flares up, right? So, you know, so one of the first things I tell my athletes sometimes is like, guess what? It's not always mental. Like, we need to look at, you know, what's happening physically, and like, is everything in place that you need in order to be able to use your body to its potential, right? You know, with this, you know, injury. And so that's part of it. And within that, it's how do I allow myself to listen to my body first? And understand that my primary goal is injury prevention over all other goals. Because when it isn't the primary goal, that's when you might see an athlete in those situations push a little too hard and or not do the recovery that they need to. Once they start to feel something happening, they just want to push through because they don't want to deal with it. They want to be able to continue to play. Like, how can I make sure that my primary goal is injury prevention so that I immediately take action and I'm only out for a couple days instead of for a couple months? And it takes a lot of discipline and mental toughness to do that, to make sure that that is your primary objective and that you're doing the things that you need to do for your body, both before and after activity in order to keep it healthy. So some of that is psychology and then some of it's physiology also.
Yeah, I know personally I'm very bad at that. So my MO has been typically to go to complete breakdown and then then okay, I will take a few months off or years off and then I'll be back.
Yeah. You're not the only one.
Because you know sometimes you feel like, oh, I'm playing so well, I gotta keep it going, you know, I can tolerate this, I can get through it, and then you reach a point where you can't.
Yep, exactly.
And, you know, and pain can be very demotivating. You know, for somebody who's experiencing in a chronic way, it just, and I'll speak from personal experience here, that it's just, you start to feel that elbow or shoulder pain again, and it's like, oh, where is this coming from? And you just don't feel like doing it anymore. And even though the rehab process, is it really working? What, you know, because something like tennis elbow or golfer's elbow or issues with the shoulder when they're more overuse, it doesn't feel like there's a real click moment where it's gone, it's better.
No, yeah. Yeah, I can tell you that from personal experience with Peggy Sue. So it's hard, right? Like to continue to have faith and trust that process and believe that it is helping or to, you know, or assess like if you feel like it's not, is there something else I need to do that I'm not doing? That's another tool I have for my injured athletes, which is stop, start, continue. Actually, I use it with my, you know, athletes that aren't injured also, but with the injury, it's looking at it. So in order to recover to the best of my ability, what are the things I need to stop doing? What do I need to start doing? And what do I need to continue doing? So sometimes you do have this process of like, if you've had a chronic injury for a long time and you might need to regroup. I'm like, okay, this isn't getting better. It's time for me to figure out what I need to do. And I just went through that process with my shoulder actually, where I like really lost hope and then recognized what was happening and had to, and was like, it's time to regroup. Like it's, and so I have my little acronym of the three R's, which is regroup, reset, recommit. And so I really had to do that for myself and then get back on track and like, look at other things that I wasn't doing that maybe I could do that was helping. And I'm so glad I did because it definitely helped. And the trajectory has been wonderful now that I allowed myself to do that. So when it comes to those chronic injuries, if it's been there for a while and it's still there and it's not fully addressed, it might be a moment of like, okay, maybe now it's time to address it. And it's hard. The reason we don't sometimes with some of those injuries is because you can play. Like, but I can play tennis and I'm playing pretty good. And so why would I stop? Like, but at some point your body will probably stop for you. So it's just trying to decide, do I want to be proactive or reactive about it? And some people are okay being reactive and that's fine too. If that's something that you're okay with, like there's nothing wrong with that. But I will tell you, some of my injured athletes would say that they wished they had been proactive instead of reactive because maybe they could have prevented certain things from getting worse.
That all makes sense. That all makes sense. Shifting gears a little bit, I know that, you know, you've done teaching and mentoring, you know, for people in the field of sports psychology. And I actually know some of that from personal experience through some of our sessions. So I was curious, you know, what if you could tell us a little bit more about that and how that has impacted your approach that you take with athletes and maybe how you see things as it relates to the field of sports psychology.
Yeah, I like the work I've done in the past. So I used to be an adjunct professor in sports psychology and graduate programs in sports psychology. And like, so worked with students and then also through that process, mentored people in their internships and then continued to mentor people as they're sort of in their early careers and building their business and even beyond that, actually. And it's really fun. It's like that part of the work that I do, what I love about it is it's fun to be able to connect with other professionals as they're up and coming in the field and share some of the insight that I have because I've been doing this for over 20 years. Like I have a lot of experience with a lot of different things with the athletes that I've worked with. And so it's fun to be able to share that with other people as they're coming into their work as well as like building the business. And, you know, cause you could be the best sports psychology, you know, practitioner out there, but if nobody knows you exist, nobody's going to work with you. So like that's a big part of the work too. So it's really it's fun for me, and I think the way it helps with my work with my athletes is it helps me stay connected with the field and with people that are excited about the field, and that makes me excited about the field. So I think that and then that comes across with my athletes of like, this is what I love to do, and I get to do it with you, and how lucky am I to get to do this. And so it's a that's a fun sort of part of my work as well.
And so with that, Carrie, what are some things that you're offering these days? What are you looking forward to 2023? I think you have a membership site, so I'd love to hear more
I
about some of
do.
that and, how people can connect with you.
So there's a couple things. I do some rebound coaching, like injured athlete groups. So for people that are wanting extra support and wanting to do it sort of in that group setting with and connect with other injured athletes that get it and that are going through it too. I run a couple of those every year. And I'm in the middle of one right now. So the next one isn't until the fall. So those are really fun to do and get to support people in that way. And then I also have my membership called Rebound, which is a mental skills training membership. And we look at mental skills both for sport and life. And that's so much fun. So people in the membership, you get a mental training tool of the month. And there's, all kinds of handouts and worksheets and videos that go with each mental training tool. And then we have our huddles where we get to talk. We do a deep dive into the tool, or we can do some Q&A on mindset for anything that's coming up for the people in the membership. So that's a really fun thing to be a part of. I love doing that. And then I have a new pro I haven't even said anything about this project yet. I have a new project that I'm working on this year. I'm not sure when it'll be out, and it's going to be a program for coaches actually, and understanding some of the tools of mental training and how you can use that with your athletes so that you can be helping to like support their mental training as you're working on their physical training, creating their training plans. And so I'm super excited about that. I haven't said anything about that yet. So now I have to do it because I said it out loud and it's out there now.
It's
So
in the universe now. Yeah, it's gonna
that's
happen.
right. Yeah. So, and I'm all over social media, so you can connect with me there too. I'm on Instagram at Feed the Athlete, on Facebook, Mental Skills Training for Athletes. And I have a blog on my website where you can check out other resources that are there too, which is carriejackson.com. So I just love giving people resources.
Well, no, it's been really a wonderful conversation today. I've really enjoyed learning more about your background and your approach. We've known each other these past few years, but it's been have just really enjoyed having you on. It's been really a pleasure, and it's just been awesome talking through some of these things. I know our listeners will get a lot out of it as well, and we can post some of that information in the show notes, just in terms of your books and how people can get in touch with you and the membership and that sort of thing.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me. This was so much fun.
Thanks, Carrie. Well, that was a great episode with Carrie Jackson. I certainly enjoyed it, and I think one of the things I took away most from it is this idea of athletes feeling isolated after their injuries. And I think sometimes they are isolated from their teammates, and maybe it's their teammates or the team environment that is isolating. And I think at other times they isolate themselves. But that's something that we talked about in this episode, and I think also something I've seen as a sports psychology professional and as a coach. And I think I think it's one of the things that athletes really need to be aware of and think about during that time of injury, because it can be so easy for that to happen, and that can make the recovery process a lot harder. So really being intentional about, if an athlete has experienced an injury, really finding ways to be involved with the team, have that social interaction still. And if you're on a team and somebody else has gotten injured, it's the same exact idea. Can we, really look to get that person involved, recognizing that they likely feel isolated, because of these circumstances. So, you really try to utilize and apply this knowledge, and be proactive about making sure people who have recently been injured are involved, because we understand how important that social connection is to, how comfortable someone feels on the team and ultimately performance.
And even if you're not on a team, because many of us are not, and this is an individual sport, so it can be easy to get disconnected from just the tennis community in general. So, can we look for ways to stay connected to those that are, can support us, whether that be family, coaches, what can we do to stay connected to the sport? Because I think the athlete identity part is what gets lost. And one of the things I really like about Carrie's book, Rebound, is, there's a whole chapter about making your recovery your new sport. And so now that's what you're dedicating yourself to. And I think that that's a great way to look at it, to really embrace that. During the episode, we talked about one particular model of emotion that goes along with injuries, which was around denial, distress, and determined coping. And determined coping, where we really want to be. And if you're embracing your recovery as your new sport, okay, now we know what to do. We're going to be coping with that in various ways. So I thought it was a great conversation. She's such a consummate professional. She's got a ton of experience, and she's extremely well known in the sports psychology field. And you can tell just through her own career of, rock climbing and other sports that are probably somewhat dangerous. She's had her own injury journey, which has kind of pushed her to do this type of thing. And so for those who have experienced injuries or want to be more prepared for that, I'd really recommend connecting with Carrie in some way, or at the very least getting her book Rebound and learning about that particular process, right? So thanks to Carrie Jackson for coming on the podcast, and thank all of you for listening. For more on today's episode, you can check out the show notes. If you have any feedback or questions for us, please email us at tennisiqpodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you have a moment, please rate and review the podcast so others can find it. Additionally, please subscribe to the show on your podcast platform of choice, including YouTube, so you can be notified of new episodes. You can also check us out on Instagram. If you would like to support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/tennisiq/membership, where you can learn about the benefits of being part of the Tennis IQ podcast community. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon in our next episode.